When our best fur friends leave our world, many of us are left wanting one last scritch, one last hug, one last walk together. One Last Network is a space for pet guardians to honor their pets in their senior years and to cope with the days leading up to and after their passing. Here's your host, Angela Schneider, founder of One Last Network and Big White Dog Photography in Spokane, Washington.
You might not want to believe what I'm about to tell you. Brace yourself. Running an animal rescue isn't all glamour, snuggles, and magical puppy breath. I know, right? Shocking. Running an animal rescue can be incredibly challenging, logistically and emotionally. On one hand, there's an immense satisfaction and joy in providing a safe haven for animals in need, giving them a chance at a better life. On the other hand, it comes with a heavy responsibility of making decisions to end an animal's life. The simple reality is, and it is going to be a tough one to hear, not every life can be saved. There may be cases where euthanasia is the most humane option, whether due to illness, injury, or behavioral issues. These decisions weigh heavily on the shoulders of those running a sanctuary, as they must balance compassion with practicality and often limited resources. Amy Castro of Starlight Outreach and Rescue in Friendswood, Texas, joins us today to talk about the ongoing burden of making those decisions. Amy is a people management and communications expert who coaches organizations on leadership building. While volunteering at one of her local rescues, she felt prompted to start her own in 2017. With upwards of 40 animals on her 7-acre property at any given time, Amy has developed a relatively thick skin when it comes to making end-of-life decisions. But that doesn't always make it easy.
Hi, good morning, Amy Castro. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
It's a great day here in Spokane, Washington. What is life like for you in Texas?
Well, it is very, very busy. The weather's good, so that's always a good thing. We had a tremendously hot and dried out summer, which caused a lot of stress for our outside animals. And then we've had this torrential rain little stretch that turned everything into a giant mud pit. So we're finally leveling out as we're heading into spring, even though it's only February, but that's Texas for you.
Yeah, exactly. So tell us about Starlight Outreach and Rescue.
Okay, so Starlight Outreach and Rescue, I started the rescue in 2017. I was volunteering at our local municipal animal shelter, and I was the head volunteer, so I had lots of various people of various ages, and got a call from one of my volunteers basically saying that her daughter had passed away very suddenly, very tragically, at the age of 14, and she was one of our kitten fosters, so she would take home little, what we call spicy kittens, ones that are kind of hissing and spitting and thinking they're all bad when they're, you know, like the size of a, I don't know, an orange or so. And so she passed away, and her name happened to be Emma. Her middle name was Starlight Hyde. And so immediately when that happened, I had the idea of starting a rescue in the back of my head, but it sounded like work and responsibility that I didn't want. But immediately knew, I mean, it was kind of scary how I knew, number one, I was going to do it. Number two, exactly what it was going to be called. I knew what the logo was going to look like. I mean, it was just like this light bulb went off. And, you know, we've been running strong ever since.
There's a certain madness that's required for running a rescue, isn't there?
Yes, for sure. You know, you think, you know, there's things that are similar and things that are very different than volunteering at a shelter. I think in most of the time when people volunteer, or even if when people volunteer at a rescue, they don't see a lot of the behind the scenes. And that's usually the stuff that makes you nuts. You know, doing a little fostering or volunteering at an event is one thing, but dealing with the day-to-day realities of caring for the animals, end of life decisions that we have to make that we don't involve volunteers in. And, you know, like we were talking about before we started recording, just, you know, dealing with the public, the people side of things, people don't realize how much you get involved in interacting with people and helping them, trying to help them solve their problems, you know, to avoid them surrendering their animals to us, because we get, you know, dozens of calls on a daily basis with people for various reasons looking to rehome their pets. And, you know, we can't always help, because in Texas, I'm not sure what it's like in Washington, but in Texas, we are the, I believe, second highest state behind California for shelter euthanasia rates. And so many of the shelters have tried to move towards this no kill, which is great. I mean, the concept of no kill is great. The reality is what ends up happening is shelters get full. They say, we're full. We can't pick up that animal. We can't take in that owner surrender. And so there's this trickle effect back on rescues, which we've seen our, you know, call for need, whether it's helping with owner surrenders or helping with strays, has just grown exponentially over the last 3 years or so because of that. So it's a constant barrage of help me, take this animal. And there's only so much space. I mean, I only have so much space in my house. I've got animals all over this. I bought this 7-acre property to have more space to rescue more animals, and it quickly fills up.
Yeah, certainly our rescues and shelters are bursting apart at the seams. Most of our shelters are no kill, with the exception of special cases, of course. Mm-hmm. But I've heard so much over the course of the last 8 years since I got into pet-related industries that Texas is just a special case. What is it about Texas? Are animals, dogs in particular, more disposable, viewed as more disposable down there? Help me out with that.
Yeah, I think there's, and I'm no expert on all the realities of why, you know, why we have this overpopulation issue, but I think there is a certain belief that, that I've heard people tell me, well, I don't want to neuter my dog because I don't want to take away his manhood. I don't want to neuter my or spay my female dog because I want her and my family to experience, you know, birth and having puppies. My dog does never go anywhere, so therefore I don't need it to be neutered. And then I think, you know, I hate to use the word disposable, but you're probably right to a certain degree that, you know, even legally in the state of Texas, animals are property, you know, just like your car or a shovel or your shoes. And so there are a lot of people who do treat them that way, that they're, you know, they're something that I own, but they're not something that I have a tremendous amount of responsibility for. When it's no longer useful to me, you know, maybe I just discard of it in the easiest way possible. And one other thing I will say that's kind of interesting, and I just speak to my own experience, that, you know, moving from my suburban home in town, so to speak, and moving out to this 7-acre piece of property and living more of a kind of a country life, you do have a tendency to see, like you had said, you have a working dog, and, you know, we have a lot of livestock guardian dogs out here. I don't personally have one, but many of my neighbors and, you know, people in the surrounding community do. And those are working dogs. They live outside, they roam, they, you know, they're not often neutered because they're, you know, I don't know, they want the testosterone or they want the animal to grow bigger, which there are some elements of, you know, development that are important as to when you neuter a dog. So I kind of understand it a little bit more, not the disposability, but just the fact that a dog has a job to do. It's not something that's supposed to be sleeping on your couch and wearing clothes and sleeping in your bed and, you know, making special meals for it. So I kind of have seen both sides of things in my experience living out here.
Okay. The only thing on that list that I don't do for my Bella is put her in clothes, because that's just wrong. But she is a couch potato and she does get special meals made.
Yeah.
She's got a good life for a livestock guardian dog.
Yeah. Well, and that's, and they have, you know, they adapt to their environments for sure.
Absolutely. So how many animals would you say you have on your property on any given day?
On any given day, I would say there's probably about 40. If you include the permanent permanent residents. So we have most of our permanent residents are either barn cats. There's probably even more than 40. Maybe it's more like 50. We probably have about 8 or 9 barn cats that were cats that either we had one that just showed up, and that's fine. His name is Tom. And then other ones were ones that we got as older kittens. And it, down in Texas, when you have feral cats that end up in shelters, especially shelters, you know, they're not always able to, they either don't have the staff, don't have the volunteers to really work with those animals and handle them and get them to the point where they're, you know, hissing, spitting and biting to going to being a pet. And sometimes I found in my 10 years of experience in doing this, that if you don't catch a kitten, for example, at a certain age, then it's very, very difficult to help them make that transition. And you need like one-on-one dedicated person to do that. And we don't always have the fosters or the time to do that individually with kittens. So many of our real feral, either cats that came to us as feral or kittens that came in as feral that we couldn't turn, for lack of a better term, have moved out to the barn. So they are out there doing mouse and rat and snake and whatever other patrol out there. But they're all fat. It's amazing. My one of my volunteers comes and feeds them, even though I fed them already at 6 o'clock this morning. When she shows up at 9, there's bowls all over my driveway for these already fat cats. So they live a pretty good life out there. And then we have 3 donkeys, a pony, and a horse that live outside. And then other than that, it's the temporary transition point. So the garage on my home has been converted to a cat room. I have a building outside my window here that is our isolation building. And right now we've got a mom and 6 kittens out there that have ringworm. So they are being treated for that and isolated so they don't give ringworm to everybody else. And then we're in the process of building a it's probably about 900 square feet total. Well, it's 1,200 if you include the outside runs. Dog building. It's like almost like a dog boarding facility, if you've ever seen that, where it's got in and out runs for the dogs and a play yard and all of that. So we'll have more capacity to take in dogs once that building is complete. And then I have my personal dogs that are obviously permanent residents and a couple of fosters in the house that we're working with. And that doesn't include the animals that we have here, don't include the ones that we have out in foster, because even though we have this, you know, facility, which is also my home, we rely heavily on fosters and that's something for anyone who's thinking about volunteering, you know, the ability to be a foster and, you know, basically freeze up a spot in a rescue for them to bring in another animal. Once my fosters are full and I'm full, that's when I have to start telling people, no, I can't help you, or no, I can't, you know, take that dog that you found on the side of the road, unfortunately.
When we welcome a pet into our homes, it's usually with the intention that we see that life through to the end. It's an expectation that we're going to face death and loss and grief for our companion animals. What's that like when you're dealing with 40 animals?
Well, oftentimes, I mean, not to say that deaths don't happen, you know, that we aren't expecting, but I will say the first thing is in rescue and the kind of rescue that we do, very often the animals that we might be getting in are going to be sick or injured in some way. We also get a lot of, you know, people will find a pile of kittens in their garage or something like that, and they assume that it's been abandoned. They snatch them up. And, you know, we can kind of tell when we've got a kitten of a certain size that, you know, if it doesn't weigh at least 2 to 3 ounces, the odds of it making it are going to be slim no matter what we do. So we're kind of already prepared that's probably an inevitability. And you just, the way I look at it is a couple of different things. Number one, I am sparing that person, whether it's an owner or a finder. Oftentimes it's somebody that found these animals who hasn't experienced the level of death that we experience here. I'm sparing them that experience because there's just nothing they can do is gonna help that. And I think knowing that you provided the animal with care, comfort, warmth, maybe it's a last meal, whatever it might be, or a peaceful death. You know, if it's something where, you know, we're gonna take it to a veterinarian and have it euthanized that, you know, it's better than the alternative would have been for their end of life.
It's a huge responsibility to have so many lives in your care. And when it comes time to make the decision for one dog, it can be overwhelming and confusing. And I know that we have quality of life scales. We want to talk to our veterinarian. Is there a different process for you when you are looking at an animal's life and thinking, ah, what do I do now?
Yeah, I think for us, some of the additional, you know, beyond the normal deciding factors that an owner might have, one of the factors might be, you know, the adoptability of an animal that has a certain condition. You know, can an owner maintain? Well, for example, we had a cat that came in that was paralyzed in its back end and couldn't urinate. And so its bladder would need to be expressed. And there are people that if it was their own pet would opt to do that for whatever time the animal had left. The challenge is that, you know, there's only so much that an animal is going to tolerate that type of intervention in many instances. And so when we've got an animal in rescue that's like that, whose bladder needs to be, you know, basically the animal has to be physically squeezed to push urine out of its body multiple times a day, that, you know, number one, is that the right thing for the animal? Is that the, you know, I always like to look at, is that the way this animal was born to live? And, you know, no matter how much it might make me feel good that I'm keeping this animal alive, you know, as opposed to euthanizing it, is that really the right thing for it long term? And then secondarily is the issue of, am I going to find a human being that's willing to take on this project of caring for this animal? So it's, you know, it's interesting that it's multiple factors that we factor in, and, you know, the end result could be, you know, different for one animal than another animal based on just one different factor. You know, it's the same thing. Like right now, I've got a blind pit bull that's living in my living room, and she was found this summer. Basically, we had a hellaciously hot summer, like 107, 114 degrees. And this dog was, a lady pulled over because the dog was laying in the road and she thought it was dead until it lifted its head up. And she picked the dog up. She had heartworm. She had, we didn't even know she was blind at first. She was emaciated. She had, obviously, you could tell by her physical body that she had been bred a lot in her life. And then, you know, whether she got away, whether they dumped her, you know, it's easy to say they dumped her. I don't know, because I don't know what happened. But, you know, that was one of those situations where it's like, okay, number one, there's the investment of money, time, and effort to treat an animal, and the toll on their body to treat them for heartworm, which we ended up doing. There's the blindness, you know, what's the quality of life for a blind dog? And then there's the adoptability, you know, am I going to find somebody who's going to take on this blind, formerly heartworm positive, possibly heartworm damaged animal that, you know, likes to run full tilt into walls and furniture. And, you know, in some instances, we might have made the decision that the best thing for the animal is to euthanize. In this particular one, because her personality is just so good. I mean, she's so loving and seems so happy that, you know, we basically treated her, and she's probably going to live out her life here. I mean, again, it's the issue of, am I going to find an adopter to take her? And, you know, for now, I have room for her here. I've got, I don't know how many dogs I have living in my house right now. My house is not that big, but I think there's five dogs out there, and she's one of them. And she's a pretty easy keeper, for lack of a better term. But what happens when the next one comes along? You know, it's tricky every single time.
It is going to be hard for some people to hear, but I think what you're saying is that not every life can or should be saved.
Yes. Yes. And I think, you know, for the people that would judge that we're making those decisions, because people do get, you know, people do get judgy sometimes. Shoot, I get judgy sometimes with the decisions that people make. But, you know, it's and I hope this doesn't sound ugly, but my thought would be if I make a decision, taking into consideration a lot of factors, you know, not just one, and I make the decision that I think the best choice for this animal, and of course, this is being made in conjunction with a veterinarian, not just Amy Castro deciding to end a pet's life, but with, you know, in conjunction with the vet, if somebody thinks that's the wrong decision, then my question is, are you going to take this animal then? And I think it comes up a lot, you know, with the medical issues, it's a little bit easier. Sometimes it's a little more cut and dried. Sometimes we get into these situations, especially with dogs, of behavior that's unsafe. And so, you know, some rescues will, and we do to a certain degree, like we'll put parameters on a rescue and say, you know, no kids under 13. But it's when we're doing it, it's not because that dog is known to bite people or bite kids. It's that dog might be too much for kids to handle. It's going to knock them down, or it might play too rough or whatever it might be. And it's not the best fit. Or maybe the, you know, younger children might not be able to follow through with certain training or behaviors. But, you know, if we have an aggressive animal who is known to have bitten people, has no medical reasons for it, we've had them to training and evaluation, you know, sometimes we might need to make that decision that the animal needs to be euthanized. And again, you might say, well, if you found a single female who never wore hats and was over the age of 40 and never had children visit and didn't have any neighbors that were children and were never going to take the dog out in public, then you shouldn't euthanize that because that's the person that should adopt that animal. Well, good. Find me that person and I will, you know, maybe consider it at that point. But it's not even just about finding that person. It's about what's kind of the greater good for the animal and for society, I think, in some instances. Like you said, some animals are either just too damaged. Maybe they've got a chemical imbalance. Maybe they've just had too many bad experiences. And it's just not safe for them to be, you know, out in the public. And one other thing I would say about that, too, is that, again, looking at it from the long-term benefits of the animal, I would rather make that decision humanely now and make that a humane process and follow through on it than to cross my fingers and say, look, I saved a life, and send that animal out into the world. And I mean, who knows? You know, somebody beats it because it's growling at them, or, you know, shoves it in a backyard on a chain because it's, you know, biting their kids or something, or worse, you know. And so, you know, we make the best decisions that we can with a, you know, a variety of factors being considered, I think.
Do you have staff and volunteers? And if so, how do you communicate the need for euthanasia for any pet with them?
We don't have any paid staff. We're 100% volunteer run. And yeah, that's a really good question. You know, it's really usually the animals that are facing euthanasia are not ones that are going to be in foster homes. Whether it's sometimes it could be an animal with an illness or something like that, that we would usually take back to the rescue ranch and kind of, you know, assess, take it to the vet and go from there. And we just, you know, we're basically just explaining it similarly to, but probably shorter than I just explained it to you, is that, you know, we lay out the factors. Sometimes I'll just flat out ask, you know, if you see, you know, here's where we're coming from, here's what we're thinking about and why we're thinking about making this decision, all things considered. You know, if that person has some other alternatives that they want to offer that we think are viable. But most of the time when you explain it and you explain the thought process that went into it, that people don't obviously love it because nobody wants to end an animal's life, but they can understand, you know, that it is the best decision overall.
I mean, when you're gung-ho about volunteering to save all the dogs and all of that, you don't really think about, It's the same as picking up a puppy. You're not thinking about 15 years from now when you have to make a decision to end that dog's life. You know, we go into volunteering because we want to save all the lives and we want to play with the puppies and get the magical puppy breath. Do you notice volunteers, any indication of volunteers suffering from compassion fatigue, and how do you manage that?
Yeah, well, again, we try to insulate our fosters as much as possible from that process. One of the ways that we manage it, to be perfectly honest, is prevention. If I get in an animal that I think is going to have an issue, physical, emotional, you know, whatever it might be, I will generally keep that here at the ranch for, and it's really just myself and my daughter that are interacting with those animals. So, it would be us that suffers from the compassion fatigue. And then sometimes, you know, I've had volunteers that, one in particular that just comes to mind when you ask that question, where she had a litter of bottle baby kittens and they just kind of started dying off one by one, despite the veterinary intervention. And that was the last, you know, it wasn't the first litter, but it was basically the last litter that she ever volunteered to do. Cause it just, you know, some people just can't handle being a part of that process. But I think for those of us who do have to deal with it, it's a matter of, you know, obviously communication, you know, making sure that we understand the rationale of why this decision is being made. I think for me personally, I think too many times humans roll their human emotions into the experience for the animal. And the animal, you know, if I decided that a certain animal, or, you know, if we decided that a certain animal needed to be euthanized and they are sitting in my home right now, it's not like a human being knowing they're going to die. And so therefore I'm lamenting the things that I haven't gotten to do, the people I'm going to miss, the experiences that, you know, that I won't have, et cetera, and anticipating what it's going to be like to die. I think for animals, and I'm not saying they don't know what's going on when it's actually happening, but they're not having that level of experience that I think humans project onto them. And so therefore, you know, I kind of console myself a little bit with that, is that they're, you know, they're here, they're having a normal day. And then we go and we see, you know, Dr. So-and-so, and the day is over. And that's kind of the end of it.
You brought up your own compassion fatigue. What's it like facing death at such a large scale?
You know, I think I had mentioned this before. I don't have any tears left. I used to cry a lot of tears. I used to second guess. And I think I've gotten a little bit more clinical in the way that I look at those types of things. And I don't know if that's good or bad. On one hand, it's good because it makes the decision easier from the standpoint of, you know, not losing a lot of sleep over it if I've made a good, you know, logical, fair, appropriate decision. At the same time, what I have noticed is that your ability to, your ability to, like, even with my own pet's death. So I had my own personal dog who I had for, we probably had her at least 12 years. We got her as an adult. And unfortunately, she died interacting. I won't get into the details, but she died interacting with another dog. And so it was obviously not an expected death. And like, I had no tears left. It's like she died. It was sad. Like on an intellectual level, I could process that was sad. And that was not the way that I had hoped she would go in her life, but you just don't have, you know, you just don't have the tears left. And I don't know if that's good or bad, because I see other people who are in rescue or veterinary care who every single one of them turns them upside down. You know, every euthanasia, we see the videos on, I'm sure you see them on YouTube and TikTok and Instagram, of, you know, that almost like a, you know, it just illustrates the reaction that people are having in those scenarios. And I look at those things and I say, gosh, you're dying a little death every single time. And I don't know if it's better to be like that or better to be like me.
I'm a former newspaper reporter, and I had a therapist look at me in 2007 and be like, hey, so you have this thing called vicarious trauma. I'm like, oh, great. It has a label. I love labels. Mm-hmm. But I struggle to show appropriate emotions in certain situations, mm-hmm. because I'm used to just turning it off in order to get the job done, right?
Right.
But since I came into dog-related businesses, I cry at the drop of a hat. And just last night, I found out that a dog I've never met, lives in New Zealand, died a couple of weeks ago, and I was an absolute puddle. So it does affect us all differently, and I don't think that there's a right or wrong way to go about it. If it's affecting you that way, then that's the way you have to own it and go forward, because it's also keeping you safe, isn't it, in a way?
Sane. That's keeping me sane.
Sane, yeah. Not safe. Yeah.
Yeah, no, but you're right. I mean, it emotionally safe for sure. And it's interesting you say that, because I mean, I'll sit and watch videos and stories and be boohooing about, I was boohooing about something on TV last night, or borderline. I mean, I wasn't like totally a wreck, but yeah, I mean, I do cry about sad stories and, animals that have been through stuff, you know, the rescue videos that you see. And it's just, I think when I'm involved in it, and I've kind of always been this way, when I'm involved in it actively, then it's just easier to kind of shut that off. And, you know, maybe it is because of trauma that I've experienced personally, even human trauma. It's like, if I can live through that, I can live through, you know, the death of a dog that, you know, that I feel like is a right decision.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of death. There's a lot of sadness. There's a lot of joy too, isn't there?
Definitely. And I think that's what I try to stay focused on. You know, it's like the ones that you actually do save. Like I think about one, I don't really remember what this poor kitten's name, his real name was, but we called him Lieutenant Dan because he had two broken back legs, and he kind of, like the movie Forrest Gump, when Lieutenant Dan, he kind of moved himself around with his front pause because that's how he needed to maneuver. And I think he had probably been thrown out of a car because of the way that his injuries were, and he was found on a freeway. And we nursed that cat for a long time, and he'd get out of his splints and we'd have to go back to the, I mean, it went on for months, bandaging his feet and keeping the casts on and then putting rubber gloves over his cast because he was very active for a little guy that couldn't use his back legs. I mean, he just was, he wanted to live. He wanted to play. He was full of life. And when you see something like that, that has, you know, after months, you get those casts off and they're walking around and then they get adopted and lead a full life, it makes all the other ones worth it. And, you know, it's, I think if you didn't have any wins, if you didn't have any saves, then it would be very hard to continue to do it. But the wins definitely outweigh the losses, and the easy cases definitely outweigh the difficult ones. Another example we just had in was a dog. I don't know what I was thinking, but had seen this dog that had been picked up by animal control that had gotten hit by a car. He had a huge wound on his shoulder that was wide open. His leg was broken, and the dog was like 130-pound Great Dane. I mean, a huge dog. And, you know, the easy thing, and what would have happened in the shelter more than likely, is would have been to euthanize him, because you start going through this, well, what if the leg can't be saved? Can a dog like that go on three legs when it carries, you know, 80% of its body weight on its front legs? You know, there's all these things that kind of go into that decision-making process. But again, he was so good-natured. You know, we did some consultations with veterinarians, and the long and the short of it, after a couple of months, we just finalized his adoption with a family last night, and they adore him. And, aww. You know, it took, you know, going into, you know, I picked him up at the shelter with his dragging leg and his open wound, meeting my vet on a Saturday when they were closed, and, you know, playing surgical assistant while she stitched his wound up, and then taking him to an orthopedic surgeon 2 hours away and, you know, getting his surgery done. It was just, you know, it's quite the rigmarole and quite the process. But, you know, it just based on all the factors and all the considerations, and the fact that, you know, if we can get this dog back on his feet, he's going to be a great pet for somebody, because he was so tolerant. I mean, when we were putting him through that, you know, that first treatment, even though, you know, he had anesthesia, but he was still awake and just put up with so much of us trying to take care of him, that I thought, gosh, if this dog can get through this, he can, he's going to be a great pet for somebody. And lo and behold, what was it? Probably 3 or 4 months process with that particular dog.
Wow. You have your own podcast?
I do. It's called Starlight Pet Talk. And I didn't mean to be like advertising. This is the only quiet place in my house. I should have taken that down. But anyway, yeah, it's called Starlight. Yeah, it's called Starlight Pet Talk. And, you know, one of the things that we try to do in our rescue, and there's a reason why we call it Starlight Outreach and Rescue, is that I believe very strongly that education is the key to so many of the pet overpopulation, stray and abandonment, behavior issues. I mean, is educating pet parents. And despite the fact that there is so much information available, people don't necessarily know where to turn, what to believe, et cetera. And I found myself having lots and lots, like when people will call, because I've got my Starlight phone and then I've got my own phone, and people will call and say, you know, can I bring a cat there to you? Or can, you know, I got to get rid of my dog. I'm moving tomorrow. Can I get, you know, can I bring it to you? Or I found this dog. Can I bring it to you? My first question is, especially for the people that are surrendering their own pets, is why are you surrendering the pet? You know, and even if it's I'm moving, I can't take it. Well, you know, without being judgmental, I just try to educate, ask some questions. Well, you know, what have you tried? Where are you moving? Have you asked about some relief on the pet deposit, whatever it might be? And I feel like I spend hours a day having these conversations, trying to help people problem solve. And I thought, okay, I'm a professional speaker and trainer by trade. Why can't I be having this conversation on a larger scale? So I started the podcast, Starlight Pet Talk, as a way to get some of these questions and problems that we deal with every day on the phone answered on a, you know, worldwide scale, in the hopes that, you know, you'll get that one person that will get the message that they need. And, you know, the validation comes through on a regular basis. We did an episode on, and this is, you know, it ties to the issue of death, but it's the death of the person versus the death of the animal. When we'll get people that are, you know, 79 years old and want to adopt a kitten or a puppy. And it's like, you know, far be it for me to judge. I'm 58 and I could drop dead tomorrow easily. You know, I'm quite sure. But, you know, thinking about what's going to happen to that pet should something happen to you, do you have a plan? And we did this whole episode talking about what the plan could be and how you really can't rely that your family members are going to take care of your pets for you, because even if they say they want to and they will, you know, they get your pet home and your pet doesn't get along with their pet. Next thing you know, they're calling me to take it. And so after I did that episode, I had a lady reached out to me who was in her early 80s. And she's like, oh, my goodness. She said, my husband and I, they don't have any children. And she said, and I knew she had purchased a puppy about a year or so before. But I don't say anything. You didn't ask me. It's not for me to judge you. But I remember thinking, why on earth would you buy a puppy at 80 something years old? And she said, you know, I was so glad I listened to that episode, because now my husband and I have had this conversation. And, you know, how do we do this when we didn't have a plan? And what's the plan going to be? Where is this puppy going to go if something happens to one or both of us? And so that's all I want, is I just want people to, you know, to start thinking, and start thinking before it's an issue, hopefully, you know, with these episodes that we do. So it's all about education and getting the information out there.
That's great. I love it. What is one last piece of advice you have for our listeners?
I would say that, okay, so I think the one piece of advice would be, whatever decisions you're making regarding pets, whether it's getting a pet, whether it is, you know, feeding your pet, whether it's, you know, behavior issues with your pet, end of life decisions, to really try to focus more on what is the best thing for the pet, not what I want. Because too many times, even with the acquisition of pets, you know, I want this kind of animal, but it's not a fit for you, your lifestyle, your budget, whatever it might be, or I want to keep my pet alive because I love them. And now we're doing all types of painful interventions and they're not having the quality of life, but they're still with you. And so I would say, you know, focus first and foremost on what is the right thing for that animal. And if that is what you do, then no decision you make is going to be a wrong one.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us today, Amy.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you because most of the time people don't want to talk about some of these subjects, but we need to.
It's a tough one sometimes.
Yeah.
Amy's dedication and passion for the animals comes through in her thoughtful, thorough answers. No doubt her work requires a combination of resilience, empathy, and a deep commitment to improving the lives of animals in her area, even in the face of tough decisions and adversity. Till next week.
I'm Angela Schneider, owner of Big White Dog Photography in Spokane, Washington, and your host at One Last Network, signing off to go get some Bella snuggles. Listen to One Last Network on whichever podcast platform you prefer. We're on Spotify, Apple, and Amazon. Don't forget to hit follow or subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And if you have a friend who might be interested in our content, make sure you share us with them. Thanks for listening.